Hello and welcome to Criterion
Close Up.
This is episode 26. I am Mark Herney and I'm here with Aaron West. Aaron, I thought you would have hit puberty by now, but apparently not.
That was actually my friend, my acronym friend, FRIEND.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Didn't that sound like...
And what does your friend look like?
Animated and, well animated. And I'm cute and likes cheese sticks.
Oh, cheese sticks. Okay. Nice. Yeah. Of course, we find out later, I didn't realize it's not. It's like a combination of like cheese and candy or something, but I don't know.
Cheese
like
and cheese fish, sticks. I think it is, actually.
Oh, that's right, fish.
Oh, delicious. Yeah, sign me up.
Yummy. So, we should jump right in. Folks, we are talking about Takashi Murakami's Jellyfish Eyes today, a bit of a divisive release from Criterion from last year in December. And but before we get into that, let's go ahead and introduce our guest, Matt Sheerdown. So welcome, Matt.
Hi, guys. Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we have a little story about Matt.
Yes, we do.
Well, this is one of the first times we have three people from Criterion Close Up.
That's right.
Long ago, when we were 26 episodes ago, we were trying to figure out a name for this show, and we did settle on one name, but it was close to another podcast, so we actually reached out to that person, and he was nice, but said, no, don't use it, please, very politely. And I think even on our first, maybe second episode, we even talked about our process of going through the collection and trying to find names. And so we settled on Criterion Close Up and started a podcast, episode 26 today. So then after episode 3, I think, somebody reached out to me and said, hey, did you know there's a YouTube, Criterion Close Up? And I look it up and I'm like, mother... I can't finish that thought.
We are a clean podcast.
And it was a good...
This is true.
It was, it was a good video essay from 2014. And we were like, oh, man, it's... And it was a beginning of a series. And so we thought, oh, well, the series apparently didn't go anywhere. Anyway, we kept on going, of course. And then I reached out to Matt. And Matt is the host of Criterion Close Up, the YouTube. And Matt...
One and only as of right now.
Right. And thank you for not being a horrible, mean, like getting your lawyers out kind of guy. We stole your name.
They were ready, I tell you. But I told them to just kind of calm down. We had other... legal issues that I won't talk about anyways. I did that video, it would have been getting close-ish to about a year and a half ago, and that kind of long wanted to do something Criterion related on my own, because a lot of my friends that are kind of film aficionados don't live in the same city as I do, so I kind of had an idea to do that, and it was super rudimentary and, done on the old non-HD Windows Movie Maker. Mm-hmm. And was uploaded onto YouTube. And I kind of did it more for fun. Thought I would have more time to do it, because at the time I was just working part-time. And not long after that kind of came out, and I had plans for a second and third and a full, running gamut of episodes. And I... got a full-time job, which required more of my time than I thought it would initially. So
that's a
good
problem.
That is a good problem to have. As we've talked about before, I live up in Canada in the province where a lot of oil comes from, and oil and gas is not doing so well right now as far as an industry. So was just fortunate that we can do the full-time thing. But I have, and I talked about this with you guys, have gotten... really, from the time it came out, even to quite literally last night, some really good comments from people saying, when's the next one coming? When's the next one happening? So nice. Even though it intended to be, regular, and then it turned out not to be regular, I do have plans and some ideas for some upcoming videos, and I think the time to be able to run them. So
cool. Well,
excellent.
Actually, I could not tell, and it's been a while since I've seen it, but I thought you brought good information to the video, and we'll go ahead and embed the video in the show notes here. I found Matt on the internet. Thanks, internet, for being able to find people. And reached out to him, and I was so glad that he was and I think, Matt, you had heard the show already, right?
I had, yeah. I had heard I'm trying to remember the first episode that I got a chance to hear, but had seen it, and it didn't register that it was even the name Criterion Close Up. I found it under Criterion Blues. So,
oh, right, yeah.
So that was sort of like, oh yeah, they do a podcast, and it's great. And then, yeah, obviously put two and two together when you reached out.
Mm-hmm. And now, Matt, when you do your second episode, our lawyers are going to be calling you about that name. I'm kidding.
Well, I think probably what I'll do is similar to what we're doing. I kind of had the intention of calling it that, but not calling every episode that. You know, if I did a focus on a one disc, like a hidden gem, I would have some kind of name for it. Or if I had a theme, you know, grandiose artistic thematic ideas and that sort of thing. So,
well, you have our blessing if you want to use it. So now, anybody else on the internet that wants to start a podcast, it can't even be CU.
This is the one time in history that we get a dual trademark on anything.
That's exactly it. We've reached a peaceful settlement. So Matt's a cool guy and a video game guy. So actually, we talked. It was like, you should guest. And this was actually before Jellyfish Eyes was announced, but everybody kind of knew it was coming. Mm-hmm. And since you, this just seemed like a good fit for you to guest with this show, just because of your interests. So I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, serendipity.
And hopefully we'll have you again too if you're available. So.
Yeah. No, I would love to jump in, and do this at any point in time.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So as we always do, we want to first-time guest, first-time caller. We want to talk about your Criterion connection. Where did you get started with a Criterion collection? Maybe what was your first release? Maybe the first one you bought? So I'll hand it to you.
This was a lot of fun to think about when you guys mentioned to think about that, because I sort of have a weird connection of becoming a cinephile. I grew up in a little, very small town in northern British Columbia, where we didn't even have a movie theater. We had a video rental store. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah. Like that. So we kind of had our small town selection of movies. And right around the time, actually just before canonical AFI 100 years, 100 movies list in about, I think, 96 or 97 that was. I remember seeing that and thinking I was a big movie person at, you know, the age of 15, and watching that and realizing I think I'd seen about 5 films on it. So I kind of became a bit of a movie buff by, oh, I want to watch that and that and that. And we were limited, but we watched what we could. So when I went to university in Edmonton, it was a huge change, because you could had all this access to all these films that I had always heard about, wanted to watch. And I started university in 2000, which was not long after Criterion had started their DVD line. And I remember going to there was a really great video rental store about 3 blocks from my university residence that just opened my mind up to anything and everything I could possibly do. I didn't own a DVD player, but we rented, or had, you know, people that had them on computers and whatnot. So I remember the 2 Criterions that I rented together as the first ones that I ever watched was Sam Fuller's Shock Corridor and Carol Reed's The Third Man. So,
oh, nice.
Not a bad way to start things.
Good start,
off, I guess.
Yeah,
not at all.
Yeah.
And you know, that was, of course, back in the old versions of it with the big blocky letters up at the top of the artwork, and but just was amazed at seeing such interesting films and the whole presentation behind things. And of course, once I found a few of those, I continued to dive into more and more. And then finally, when I scraped up enough money to buy one of those expensive newfangled DVD players.
I remember when those were newfangled.
I know, yeah.
Technology moves fast, yeah.
I don't know if I want to admit how much I paid for it, but it was it was about as much as my Nintendo Wii U costs, I think.
Same here, my first DVD player, yeah. A couple, $200-$300, I think.
Yeah, I was right in that neighborhood, I think, too. But the first, again, 2 that I bought kind of together, was a film that I had already loved and wanted the Criterion Edition, and that was Monty Python's Life of Brian. And then the other one was a total blind buy, which for your first Criterion purchase to be a blind buy is a tad ridiculous. But I had just before I did, I bought it, I had just seen and been blown away by Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes.
Oh, wow.
A good one.
So I blind bought Black Narcissus.
Oh, wow.
Sort of
great.
The, oh, I've heard this is, you know, in the same area, and the color cinematography is amazing, da-da-da-da-da. And it's actually gone on to be one of my favorite films ever across the gamut. So nice. That led to the addiction, and I'm looking at a shelf with way too many of them right now. So it's...
there's no such thing.
Started a revolution, I guess.
Well, I'm sure it'll come up on this episode, but Pokemon, collect them all.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's definitely a sickness for sure that starts. But, you know, it's you can't go wrong. If you're going to blind buy something, I mean, Criterion's the label to do it with. You know,
oh, exactly.
Hardly a bad movie.
No, and found that out. Yeah,
we'll talk
about that a little later on.
that was great, Matt. Thank you. Love the history, man.
Thrilled to have you, Matt.
Yeah, I'm pumped. This is fun.
And we have a lot of Canadians on this show. What's up with that, Mark?
I know. It's great. Well, I live pretty close to Canada, and I don't know what your Canadian connection is. I guess through your wife, Erin.
We're honorary Canadians.
So before we get into our short takes for the last part of our intro, we wanted to just mention some schedule housekeeping updates. So folks can find the current really kind of solid schedule, although always subject to change, at criterionclosesup.com/podcast. So we do have a number of titles upcoming listed through February, March, and April, and really our titles that we have talked about in the past. We also have a few upcoming titles that we're really tentatively slotting. We're trying to get May and June in there, but I think we did mention before that we want to finally delve into a box set. And our first box set is going to be the Krzysztof Kieslowski trilogy, the Three Colors trilogy. So looking forward to that. And also looking to hit a double feature of American Friend and Purple Noon. Paris Belongs to Us, looking at that in July. Really timely here with the unfortunate passing of Jacques Rivette.
And
upcoming,
who knows, we might bump that up. But we also Valerie and her Week of Wonders too, and with a subtopic of Czech cinema, so that'll be a big episode. Now we should also mention somebody had left a comment on the podcast page that was disappointed that we had changed, because I think we had thrown up 4 months worth of schedule back in late summer. Really what we wanted to cover, but of course what we want to cover and what we can cover a lot of times is different, and we've learned our lesson. We're waiting until we know the dates before we put this up. But just to reiterate, some are subject to change, and if we get a guest that fits one show, this person was disappointed that Revenge and Rushmore didn't happen, I believe, and I think there might have been one more. And we just didn't have a guest that fit that. So we replaced those with other ones, and we are full up through May, and actually really even beyond May, scheduled with guests. So we don't want a guest to come on and hate a film. Or maybe we do. I don't know. Do we want that, Mark?
Well, just a dissenting opinion, but sure.
And I should add, we're on an episode about jellyfish eyes, so just putting that out there.
Throwing that out there.
So anyway, it probably will be a month or two before we put a schedule on there. Probably one of the earliest shows will be A Brighter Summer Day, if people want to keep an eye out for that. But we'll put it up maybe in a few weeks.
Cool. So let's just delve into our short takes. This is a newer part of the show that we've been doing, where we talk about what we've been watching recently. And we're just going to go into a little round table. We'll each cover a couple one at a time. So, Matt, I'm going to throw it to you. What's something that you watched recently?
I had the chance this week to actually go through a Criterion release I had bought and hadn't had a chance to actually watch probably for a couple of months, I guess. And talking already about Carol Reed's The Third Man, it was Odd Man Out.
good
which
one.
Is the film that was very much kind of the beginnings of the Third Man, as visually and storytelling wise, working with Carol Reed, and was really looking forward to getting a chance to see that, and I always love anything with James Mason in it, and was really impressed. I love the visual style that they were sort of drawing out. You could see it wasn't fully stylistic like the Third Man ended up being, but it was definitely looking at that light and shadow, and utilizing sort of the Belfast setting of the story to create some interesting visuals out of a fairly basic story, but you know, always creating something really interesting, character driven, like a lot of Carol Reed's films end up being. But was really, really impressed with just the way that he was able to sort of weave the tale, and without really having to be too heavy-handed on, you know, major amounts of this story, that story, da da da. It was simple, but it was really, really well executed.
Great performance too. I think Mason is fantastic.
Oh, and you know, several others, really great character performances, is a Carol Reed hallmark. And you know, everybody from the you know, sort of his gang of people to the love interest and the pastor, I can't remember the name of it, but all kind of weaving things really, really delicately, and yeah, it was really a fun watch, and so really good. The documentary, the kind of background of it with I have it in front of me to look at here. Talking about the music with the music caller Jeff Smith that's
yeah,
on there.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, really. The you
music's
know, and,
great, yeah.
And it would just even go further with the wonderful zither score that they would do for the next film. Yeah. And actually also was a really neat inclusion to have a little documentary called Home James about James Mason going back to his hometown, which was very, very... kind of different. It was kind of in the 70s, so it was when James Mason was a little further on in age, but I mean, as always, he's kind of like Richard Attenborough. He could talk about just about anything and people would want to listen to him, so.
And he had that voice too, so anytime he talked, you're listening. And I can't do a James Mason impersonation, but I think Eddie Izzard does a good one.
I have seen that, actually. He does a very good one. Anytime I jump into James Mason lines, I seem to land on the lines from North by Northwest more than anything else, because when you start quoting Lolita, people just look at you funny. So
it's funny that you mentioned these two are Odd Man Out, because I do these lists, and the last one I did was 47, and I think I had Black Narcissus number one and Odd Man Out, I think, was number two. I it's not in front of me, but it feels like it should be. If not, it was in, you know, number three or four. So yeah, great movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was really happy to get the chance to explore through it.
Oh yeah, nice. we give 1 through 10 ratings too. So you want to take a stab?
That one's probably, I don't know if it would be up quite to the level of the Third Man, but I think it's a real solid 8.5 out of 10.
That's fair. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, not one I've seen yet, but just looking for a Carol Reed reason to delve into it. So glad to hear you watched it, Matt.
Well, worth it, Mark. Yeah,
nice. And it's a much less expensive one to dive into if you don't own The Fallen Idol, because that can probably go for a little pricier.
Yeah,
I do have that one. I picked it up a few years ago. I kind of want to pair the two together, so eventually I'll get to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have it over there sitting on my little shelf.
Well, I'll go next with my first short take. I actually got to a Film Society local screening of a film that is nominated for Best Foreign Language Movie in the Oscars this year, in Mustang. So this is from Turkish director Deniz Gamze Arguven, I believe it is.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Mustang Sally. Sorry, wrong movie.
It applies. And she's a Turkish director, but she lives in France. So it is actually the French Oscar entry this year. There are some other ones out there. I actually haven't seen any of the other ones. This is the only one that I've seen. But if it won, I would certainly be happy with it. It's about five orphan teenage sisters enjoy the summer in their village in northern Turkey. But then some actions that they take are misinterpreted, and they, trying to keep them pure, the family really effectively imprisons them. And that's about as far as I'll kind of go into it, because it's certainly worth seeing. I'm just going to briefly share one of the viewers really aptly put his, really succinctly put his comments about this movie, and I would certainly agree. He said that this movie keeps punching you in the face like a big bad sister. It's all about the girls. I've raised some. I've loved some. There's nothing like this movie. I've never seen this kind of portrayal of girls before in the movie, though I have so often in life. Everyone in the world should see this. So, I would definitely agree with that. I think it is really true to life, but also comments on the and I know this is kind of controversial, but the cultural sayings that it does say about Turkey, I think, during this time frame are important too. So Mustang, I'm sure it will be coming to Netflix and other streaming venues soon. I would give it an 8 out of 10, very solid film, well worth checking out. So how about you, Aaron?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Mustang, because it was a trailer yesterday to the film I saw.
Oh, excellent.
But I missed it. I was in the restroom. So I knew it was going to be I saw the very, the title at the end, and I asked my wife, I said, oh, that's the French nominee. And she goes, oh, it's French? It looked, it didn't look French to me, but.
It features one of the actors who plays the uncle was in the film Winter Sleep from Neri Bilge Ceylan. Connection there, and the title is appropriate too. Mustang, you can think about fast cars, of course, a group of wild horses. With the five girls, certainly appropriate. So good movie.
Yeah, I think Son of Saul has got the inside track on the Oscar, but we'll see.
I think you're right.
That's one I want to. I can't wait to see that one. I don't know when it's coming to smaller cities, but anyway, yeah. So I'll talk about the one I saw yesterday. Segues well. I saw Room. Not The Room. In fact, I shared a funny review to you, Mark, earlier about how somebody said false advertising was a terrible adaptation. It didn't even have Tommy or Lisa. Nobody was being torn apart. No, Room was. Have you seen it, Mark?
I didn't get to see Room yet. No.
Okay, well, it's Oscar-nominated, and it looks to be the inside track to the Best Actress winner. Looks like Brie Larson. And so it's
she won the Golden Globe, if I remember. So
yeah, she did.
She just won the SAG, so she's pretty much cleaning up. So we'll see. I think she's a great young talent. So I haven't seen all the Oscar contenders, so I really can't speak. It was a great performance. It didn't really seem like Best Actress worthy to me, but but again, not to take anything away from it, it just I haven't seen it yet, but I have a feeling that I'm going to appreciate Carol a little more, but that's we'll see. But it's really two movies, and I'm not going to really go into the details of both of them, but basically one movie splits in half, and that's the first part is the Room part, and then the second part is a different movie. And so, in fact, my wife and I agreed on this. The first half was great, just amazing direction and performances. One of the best child performances I think I've seen in a long time. And I think the director really deserves credit for getting, somebody that young. It's not easy to get such a solid performance out of. And then the second half, it meanders a little bit. I'm not going to go into too much why we didn't like that, but overall we still like the movie. I think we'll give it a 7, and it's nominated for picture, writing, director, and Brie Larson.
Nice.
I was really happy to see that she's getting as much attention as she has, because she's done a lot of really interesting roles in the last few years leading up to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's, it does, when you look at Oscars, Oscars loves their mid-20s young hot thing who uglies themselves up for a role.
We said that very funny.
Yeah. But she's really, like you said, she's a great young talent, and I haven't had a chance to see it yet either, but it's one that it's on the list of things that I probably need to see before Oscar night.
Yeah, she does ugly up for sure, as much as she can. But yeah, she was really good in Short Term 12, and I think she's had a bunch of supporting performances. You know, she was in Scott Pilgrim, Spectacular Now. So yeah, it's
Trainwreck from this year.
Yeah, that's right, Trainwreck. Mm-hmm. So yeah, yeah, and now I saw she's doing the Kong sequel. So
yeah,
yeah. Well, you know, you got to get paid, I guess. But anyway.
Nice. So how about you, Matt? Well, as we said, we'll do two. So what's your number two?
Well, I actually have another one that's in the race for several Oscars, actually, that I got the chance to see with my brother a week from what we're doing right now. We got up for an early screening of The Revenant, which
excellent.
Was obviously a big-time heat for the Oscars and everything else. It's actually a film that there's a little bit of a connection to for geographically for me, because it was actually filmed in the area I live in, to kind of about half an hour, 45 minutes outside of Calgary in the Kananaskis area of Alberta, kind of going towards Banff, Canmore, and that sort of thing. So a lot of the principal photography and the mountain scenes that you see have been scouted there. And there's actually been quite a few films in the last 5, 6, even 10 years that they've started to come to Calgary more, rather than just going to Vancouver and calling it every city ever in the world.
Toronto. They
or Toronto. That's true. They do a lot of it there. But, you know, it kind of started with the big, at least, movie started with Brokeback Mountain, which was filmed in this area as well. And obviously the cinematography in it is absolutely astounding. Luz Becky is just an incredible
cheapo
artiste, as far as that, yeah.
On top of his game.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of new going in. I was actually expecting it to be a lot less dialogue than there ended up being, because what I read of the story kind of synopsis, I thought this is going to, I think, be almost like a silent movie where a lot of the acting comes from facial expressions. But I was surprised that there was actually at certain points a good bit of back and forth and dialogue, especially more kind of with Tom Hardy and with I pronounce his name wrong all the time. Gleason? What's his first name?
Domhnall Gleeson.
Domhnall.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. I was waiting
for DiCaprio. It's DiCaprio.
Yeah, that guy was in The Basketball Diaries.
It doesn't have an Oscar yet.
Yeah. Not for too much longer. I think we can quell that after seeing the performance there. It's pretty much getting as close to put through hell as you're going to get. And it really was just blows you away with just everything that goes along with it. And the fact that it's a true story, and there's a lot of things that Inuyuritu is able to weave in there that, without being too heavy handed as far as thematic content goes. But yeah, it is every bit as much as you hear of an excellent movie. And probably one that if you have any interest in seeing it, the big screen is definitely the way to see it.
Yeah.
Mm. It really treats its landscapes like so many other great outdoor films. And the fact that it's set in the wintertime as it is, it makes you feel the cold and the struggle that everybody's going through with it. But was really impressed by it, and I was a little bit skeptical, as I think a lot of people are when you see a movie get that many Oscar nominations and
right so much buzz,
and a lot of times that you get to it and you go, oh, okay, well, that was what it was, but this is pretty special. And I've been a fan of Inuyuritu for a long time, since Amores Perros, and he's really coming into his own right now.
Yep, sure is.
Nice. Well, that it really transitions well into my next pick a little, because I was on the First Time Watchers podcast this week, where we talked about our top five of 2015. So that movie did play a part there.
Mm-hmm.
So folks can take a listen to that, and I'll be posting my top 10 of sorts for as many movies as I was able to see on Letterboxd. But we also we talked about the top five of 2015. And we also recorded a piece for an upcoming episode of a little synergy with Aaron's movie, The Room.
Oh, hi, Mark.
I meant to start this episode with Oh, hi, Matt and oh, hi, Aaron, but you know, missed opportunity.
Boy, so, yeah. It's a masterpiece, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's seriously, you could call it a masterpiece of bad movie making.
I
was looking forward to this because they had let me know a few months back that we were going to do this, and I've heard things, and I've always been on the boat a little bit of, you know, can there really be a movie that is so bad it's good? And this made me a believer.
Yes. it's the gift it that really keeps on is. Giving.
It's just so, I mean, I had mentioned there, Kubrick is like an auteur gone right. And of course, there's many other examples, but Wiseau is so, such an example of an auteur gone wrong. you know, it's just, it's so much fun. I mean, there's a How Did This Get Made podcast that stars the or guests Sestero. Greg Sestero was on there. He was basically one of the cast and crew of the movie, and he gives so much insight into it. I definitely recommend it. But it's
he was Mark.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Greg played Mark. Oh, hi, Mark. Mm-hmm. So, and it's amazing to me, you know, Wiseau is still getting work. I mean, he's working on, he was on Samurai Cop 2, Deadly Vengeance, highly rated movie, and he had the Tommy Wise show, but yeah, it's something else. I mean, I've got to say, I purchased the DVD, and I was talking to Aaron, like, you know, should I really buy this? You know,
yes.
Is it worth $9? It's so worth, it's the best $9 I've spent in some time. It's great. I mean, I wish the DVD had a commentary. That would be the only thing that would have made it just absolute gold. But it's, you know, some of the quotes from the trailer are just incredible. And they have no sources given. You know, so I think these are really Tommy's words, where he says, you know, it's a riot with the passion of Tennessee Williams, and experience this quirky black new comedy and the best movie of the year. So, yeah, it seems like it's really him coming out after, you know, people's reaction to the movie. He didn't really expect it to be funny, but it really is. So he's kind of trying to spin it that way. So. He's
classic undersell.
He's been revisionist. Now he tries to say, and I think even the new DVDs say drama comedy or something. No, it was not a comedy. We've been exchanging a lot of funny comments during the week, just knowing you're funny. I'm obsessed with The Room. I think it's, again, it's a masterpiece. I don't care if it's horrible. I love it.
Yes.
And anybody says otherwise, shut up and put your comments in your pocket.
Which is a line. Shots are fired.
No, that's a line from the film. It's a classic line. I use that regularly. But there's a documentary coming out called Room Full of Spoons, and I actually contributed to the Kickstarter probably about a year ago, not knowing what it would become or, you know, how it would evolve. And back then they had Tommy as he was involved. He's not involved anymore, but they've actually tracked down his whereabouts or his origins, and that's something he's very secret. It's very mysterious. Yeah. And I just saw, actually this morning, I just saw an article that tracks down where he's from. And do you want me to tell you?
Sure.
He's from Poland.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I did see that. I had heard that he was had some French origin, but was from Poland, so, yeah.
Yeah, I guess...
I kind of thought you were going to say he was actually Uwe Boll.
Or from Mars, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, he does look alien, it's true.
I think he was... we'll see when the documentary comes out, but apparently they like even went to visit grave sites to look at his ancestors. But yeah, it sounds like he was... he left post-war, his family left post-war and went to Louisiana and maybe France in between. But yeah, fascinating guy, fascinating movie. Who knows how he got all that money to make it, but who cares?
Yeah.
Well, some people might care.
Glad he did.
Some authorities might care. I don't know.
So that'll be coming soon from First Time Watchers. So I'll let folks know once that's up. We had a fun discussion there for sure.
I can't wait. What's your rating?
The grades were great.
We didn't give ratings. What's Revenant, Matt?
I liked it. I would give it a 9.
Wow.
I think it was worth that.
Okay. And Room? The Room.
Room.
The Room.
Okay. Well, I'll spoil my rating on First Time Watchers. As a movie, it's, you know, as a real movie, I gave it an F. But as a So Bad It's Good movie, fun to watch, it's absolutely an A+. Tim on First Time Watchers gave it an AF+. You can probably guess what the F is. So
yeah, I think I can. I can't wait to listen. Oh, and Regular Room is a 7. Regular Room is a better movie than The Room, but not a better movie than The Room.
Yes. Yeah. We know exactly what you're saying.
Exactly.
So what else did you see, Aaron, or what do you want to talk about?
I saw a few things, but I did crack open another box set, and that was the BBS story.
Oh, yeah.
Which cool. I've seen a number of those. I've seen, off the top of my head, 5 Easy Pieces, Last Picture Show, and Easy Rider. So I started with Head, the Monkees drama, and I'm not a big Monkees fan. I am a big music fan of all genres. We talked about Bowie recently, but not the Monkees. Sorry. Although I think Michael Nesmith is a genius. We talked about him with Alex Cox, and I think Bob Rafelson is a genius too, because he took this this band that was terrible, subjectively terrible. He took this band that was subjectively terrible and made them into an art film, or sort of a, I don't even know how to describe it. It's such a whacked out movie, and it's a lot of vignettes, and they are the Monkees, and they're doing they're kind of doing their thing for the camera, but it's so creative and so inventive. I thought about Benwell a lot when I was watching it. In fact, I thought about a Benwell that came out afterward, which is The Phantom of Liberty, because which is a great film. I recommend anybody see it. Different, you can't compare the two, but it's just another kind of absurdist vignettes. And yes, some are better than others. There are some fun cameos. There's Frank Zappa. There's Jack Nicholson. Dennis Hopper. And there's some bad scenes too, but overall I thought it was pretty decent. I think I also settled with the 7, probably would have been higher if it weren't for those Monkees.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun as a film. It was kind of the beginning of that tradition of bands doing. I mean, Hard Day's Night was not anywhere near as weird as Head was, but right. It was that the beginning of that for a lot of different bands and a lot of. What initially would you call creative fun and eventually ended up being just over the top. But
eventually music videos.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. That's very true.
But it's really in between. If you want to do the this meets that, it really is a Hard Day's Night meets like Phantom of Liberty. Or I'm sure you could think of another film from earlier, but that just sticks in my mind, even though it's like 8 years later or 6 years later. So yeah, that's my short takes.
Cool. Well, that was great, guys. Thank you. That's it for our intro and short takes. We'll transition with some music from Jellyfish Eyes, and we'll get into it. Welcome back, everyone, to Criterion Close-Up. We are on episode 26 and talking about Jellyfish Eyes. I am here, of course, with Aaron West, and our special guest this week is Matt Sheerdown. And, we wanted to jump into it. This is a interesting release from Criterion, Spine number 787, from artist-turned-director Takashi Murakami. Really not a first-time director, because he also directed the Kanye West video Good Morning. You can find that out on the YouTubes, of course. Little synopsis, this is a movie after moving to a country town with his mother following his father's death. A young boy befriends a charming, flying, jellyfish-like sprite, only to discover that his schoolmates have similar friends and that neither they nor the town itself are what they seem to be. So that's from the Criterion site. And there are some themes that Criterion points out. They do a good job of, really getting you to think about the, what was important in the film to them as they selected the movie, which I think kind of informs this film a bit, because they mentioned friendship, loyalty, humanity's propensity for destruction, cooperation, hope, and set in a post-Fukushima world. So,
oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
That explains everything, right?
Yeah.
So this movie is not, it's an interesting release from Criterion. It's not very highly regarded, at least here in the U.S. I tried to find out what the really consensus was in Japan and really couldn't find it, but it has a 4.7 on IMDb and an 18% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not a a ringing endorsement, certainly. So,
as Geely numbers, that is.
Yes. Mark, yeah. We need more negative energy. That's a line from the film. So. In case you haven't seen it, there's plenty of negative energy surrounding this film.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of the comments. We do have a little bit of feedback and some letterbox comments to share. But
and listener comments.
And listener comments, thank you. And we thought we would really jump into it, talking more on the anime and manga culture and video game culture that really does inform this movie a bit. So, Aaron, I'll turn it to you because you have a little bit of insight there, I believe.
Yeah, key phrase, a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe most of any of us. When I think of, I guess, as an art film fanatic, when I think of anime, I think of Miyazaki, I think of Akira, I think of Studio Ghibli, maybe The Grave of the Fireflies, you know, a lot of those, they kind of walk, you know, some of those are more art film than others, you know, Princess Mononoke may be closer to, you know, I guess, mainstream anime. Manga is something that I'm just not too up on. Now, I do have a brother, however, that was very into anime and manga, and he was into Pokemon, and of course we talked about Pokemon cards with David Blakesley and the how some decks are stronger than others.
Mm-hmm.
I was never in that world.
Star Wars.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So I'm from what I gather, and you know, I'm not the authority. I'm just I just took one for the team. But you know, I mean, I think we have a good idea what anime films are. As far as manga, you know, I think they're more printed versions, and I think like in Jellyfish Eyes, the second half when you see that that girl, I think that seems more like a manga type of character.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So I think this has roots in both of them. Both genres, but it's kind of also blending, you know, standard, you know, it's definitely influenced by Hollywood too. So I think it's a blending of Japanese, American, you know, all sorts of cultures, and Murakami's art, which of course we'll get into.
Sure, yeah, definitely a pastiche, and certainly some video game culture too. I mean, you see that with the cell phone type devices that they use, where they're controlling the friends, the animated characters in the movie, and they do make them fight. So I know you're well versed on video games, Matt. So you know, do you want to talk a little bit about that and how that informs this movie a bit?
Yeah, for sure. I actually do on a fairly regular basis with my brother. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Twitch. Which is kind of a site, twitch.tv is sort of the broadcast of sort of a video game, a lot of video game related broadcasting content. The majority of what goes on there is a lot of gameplay with people talking to it, whether they're doing Let's Plays or sort of instructional how-to stuff, or even just do sort of comedy variety hour with video games to it. My brother and I do about five times a week streaming over on Twitch, kind of for a variety of different video games and such, just because we both enjoy it and it's kind of fun to do. And I'm more of the video gamer of the nostalgic factor. I love the retro video gaming, and obviously I don't have my camera going, but I have my Super Nintendo collection behind me here. So,
nice.
But there's definitely, Jellyfish Eyes really hits on it's sort of what you call modern video gaming, I guess, especially through the lens of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really big difference between video game culture in North America versus video game culture in Japan. There always has been, but there's a big one major difference between Japanese culture and the North American one, and it's that handheld gaming is king in Japan. It is absolutely the biggest thing. The biggest selling consoles currently in Japan are Nintendo 3DSs, which are the handheld two-screen devices where one's a touchscreen and one's more of a display. They are quite popular in North America as well, but they the 3DS is actually not quite double, but almost double PlayStation 4 sales in Japan.
Wow.
Wow.
So it's a pretty big deal, and they for quite some time there's been a lot of focus on producing games for the Japanese market that don't come over to North America, and some of the ones that do in the Jellyfish Eyes vein, obviously you guys have mentioned Pokemon being sort of the grandfather of a lot of them, but there's a lot of games that come out in this way of that the friends are in Jellyfish Eyes, where it's, you know, it's a person and they have a creature or a group
Avatar.
Of creatures that they they're very similar in that way that it just sort of it goes in that direction of maybe they battle with them, maybe they take care of them, you know, it's sort of a mix somewhere between Pokemon and the old Tamagotchi. You know, feeding your creature and keeping them alive, and supposed to putting them out to fight and battle and whatever else goes on. In fact, the really big one that's in Japan is called Yokai Watch right now, which is eerily similar to the friends in Jellyfish Eyes, except the government shadowy, you know, shadowy devil-like figures don't give them to children like in the film. It's it's a little more of a find and tame and use for your adventures. So I think the use of it in the film really gets at that idea of the Japanese youth culture of having these things that they always have with them, and you know, they're just what, like in their pocket and a couple of clicks away from being engaged with the game or with other people playing the game against each other, whether it's battling or elsewhere. But I think that's a big theme that mirrors in Japanese gaming culture right now.
Now, can we summon creatures with these Japanese games? Because that's what I want. I want to summon a creature.
You want a creature.
You want a Pokeball. The Pokeball where you keep your creatures, your Pokemon, your yokai, and your friends, whatever you want to call them.
I want that big, like, Snuffleupagus kind of guy, more where the wild things are kind of guy. I want him.
Luxor.
I'd see Luxor's right out of the Jim Henson studio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Good call there. I thought he was more, I thought of him as like a, you know, like a sensei or something like that. I was expecting him to, you know, follow that vein, but not so much, more of a protector.
Yeah, the gentle giant.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and the creatures are really all over the place, too, these that they summoned. You know, one looked like, and I don't know if your generation remembers this, but there was a Manchichi doll for a while. And I don't know if that came from Japan or had some sort of, but yeah, anyway. It
had
won,
some roots there, yeah.
Had some roots, yeah. And then there's another...
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you still going? I'm sorry.
I was also just going to say that it was fun for being a retro video game geek at the one part in the film where they're scanning through the, I don't know what you would even call it, the room with the circular...
The Tai Chi?
Yeah.
The Yin Yang? I'm sorry.
Yeah. There was a part scanning across, you know, the bottles strewn about and computers everywhere, they had... an old Famicom system, which is the Japanese version of the NES.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
It was sort of placed in there, and I believe I had seen a couple of other older video game devices, a Game Boy or two, strewn
kind
around.
Kind of little
somewhere.
Easter eggs for that audience, you think?
Mm-hmm, I think so.
Yeah. Nice eye, Matt. I didn't notice those.
Yeah, there's not a lot going on in video gaming and films that is usually a good thing. So you can those of us that have that background to it, you can usually spot them.
And frankly, if I had spotted it, I would never have made the connection. So or any connection. In fact, I can watch it 5 times and never see that.
Yeah, there you go.
I did make a film connection a little bit too. Just of course being a film guy, and there's a series of books. But I thought of the Daemons in the Golden Compass that film that came out a few years ago.
Okay.
So kind of, you know, as the friends as being you know, really surrogates or, you know, avatars, like you said, Aaron, a bit there. But those are characters that are a part of the soul of the character. So I thought maybe it would go there, but it really did really, I think, stick to the kind of video game culture, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't read those. So I guess the Damons, you mean Matt Damon, right? The Martian?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Oh, so this was it was a comedy. I get it. That's
we
cool.
Can, we can summon Martian comedians.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of comedic, this isn't the first time we've talked about Jellyfish Eyes, Aaron. You did bring it up on the Criterion Cast 2015 in review, I remember.
I did. I don't know if I would call that comedic. I would say that was more hate speech.
Ouch. Not Triumph of the Will level.
No,
but,
no,
yeah.
No. Or, well, I could make another connection. I'm just going to move on. I watched it, and as a lot of listeners know, I had surgery right actually the day after that we recorded that Criterion Cast episode, and so I watched it the weekend before. I don't want to say I had a closed mind, but I just was watching it hoping for light entertainment, and turned out hating it. So I did decide to give it another chance, actually focus on it. I actually watched the supplements first this time to get the context, and then I rewatched it. I also heard some other comments. Some people do like this movie. Some people I respect like this movie quite a bit. And in fact, I'll mention that one of the listener comments we got is from David Blakesley, our good friend. And I'm going to share those. There's a lot, so I might kind of split those up a little bit. I wanted to take another look and see what I found. And, well...
So as going through it then with the supplements kind of behind you, what came out to you as... Was there anything you thought that, oh, well, I didn't think of that in that light the first way through?
I think the character models, the creature models, the special effects, the production design, I think a lot of that... I should also mention that my first time watching it was on an iPad, whereas this time I was, on a big screen TV with the lights off. It helped a little bit. It did help with the visuals, and I did like that aspect more on the second viewing. And the supplements helped too, and we'll get into the supplements later. Everything else went the other way. I actually... I'm sorry, I came out disliking this movie more.
Okay.
But not to the point where I'm just going to trash it. And, as we dig in, I'm not going to be haterade. I did have some problems with it. And I don't know if you want to... I did actually note some of those problems. If you want me to get into them now or if you want me to wait for ratings, what do you think?
Yeah, sure. I think it'll inform the discussion. Let's get into it.
Okay, well, I basically thought that I actually saw some things in the supplements that made me like it less. That it seemed like Murakami was going for an international audience, so I don't think it's a cultural... There's definitely a cultural barrier, but I'm not sure that he... I think he was actually writing this for us, just maybe a little misguided. I thought it was a little bit of an E.T. ripoff and not as well done. There were certain plot similarities. I thought the writing was...
He actually references it, too.
Yeah.
I thought the writing was not very well done. The story was not very well developed, even, the plot. In fact, I'd say the writing was pretty bad. I thought the characters within, you had the good guys versus bad. You had the hooded cloaks, the antagonists... they almost served, they were both evil and they were like exposition sponges. They just kind of like, they defined friends and all that. And there are some silly scenes that I just thought took away from the film. It was predictable, and we're not going to go into spoilers, so I won't really go into how. I also saw a lot of Harry Potter too. In this, in that, it's kids, and the protagonist has, is sort of special, but he's also kind of bullied. Harry Potter had the glasses. This kid was, maybe a little smaller than the other kids, didn't quite fit in. There's a mad scientist. There was like the uncle, I guess it was sort of like a Hagrid character.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a little bit of melodrama. that wasn't really, I didn't really think it was earned. There was some romance, I mean, with the kid, the boy and the girl, yeah, that I didn't really think really was developed or really went anywhere. So, yeah. And mainly, I thought it had artistic elements. And, you know, when I think of artists turned filmmakers, I think of, like, Julian Schnabel. I think of Steve McQueen. And I actually really like Murakami's work. And, in fact, I'll try to find some and put some on the show notes here. I did see those visually, but it didn't really translate in as far as storytelling into what I wanted to see. So there's my haterade speech.
No, and pretty good stuff to digest. Excuse
me. Yeah, and I don't think that's, you know, I think that pretty much is probably the same reason that people that enjoyed the film, they probably enjoyed it for the reasons that you didn't enjoy it. Like it's very black and white, I think. Mm-hmm. As far as just it appealing to you or not. I do think there's a lot of, I felt like when, as it was going on, there was a lot of pop culture references and a lot of historical references and religious references and mm-hmm. Japanese mm-hmm. culture references, to the point where it very much at one point I thought this is a huge overload of themes and what's going on. And it did, as I thought about a little bit more, kind of mirror what Murakami's art goes for, or it has gone for after a certain trend, you know, with him doing some commissions for Louis Vuitton and mm-hmm. having a lot of his art be made to be internationally recognized, not necessarily made to be an at-home Japanese representation. It's more of a representation of that to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think that's fair. He's almost like a modern pop artist that's rooted in Japanese culture, but accessible. So I think that's fair.
And I think a lot of what I've read a really good comparison, and I don't think this is one that is a big secret to anybody, but very much in comparison to somebody like Andy Warhol.
I thought of that too, yeah. Just mm-hmm. no tomato cans. We have video game creatures.
This is true. We have friends instead of Dracula and Frankenstein as far as...
Yeah. Right, yeah.
I wonder, you know, I mean, looking at the movie, you talked about this a little bit, Aaron, you know, wondering what genre it is, who this movie is made for. And I think you touched on it somehow. Looking at this movie, I wondered how much of it I was really missing because of, you know, coming from an American culture. And he does in the supplements refer to some items like the some of the fight scenes where he put that in really to cater to some Western audiences. Mm-hmm. He did seem to be making this for a Western audience. So I'm curious what you guys think about who the audience was. And I'll just kind of start off a little bit where it did feel like this movie was even, it seems, feels like it caters to kids.
I thought that too. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I wonder, you know, who the audience is. And I think one of the things that he refers to is there's in Japan, there's a less of a distinction between high art and popular art. And I mm-hmm. think, you know, this really feels like a pop movie, and it really feels to me like the first, maybe the first pop movie that Criterion has released. So, mm-hmm. you know, I appreciate it in that way, but, you know, you have that culture of the fighting, that I think, again, we're missing that a little bit with the, there is a lot of martial arts between the different friend characters, and also you've got the KO2 character who's really recycled from a previous sculpture, I believe it was, or drawing that he had done. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is a little voluptuous, and I would say suggestive for if this is really for kids. So, curious what you guys think about that.
I actually pulled a quote. Oh, I'm sorry, Matt.
No, keep
going. I'll be really quick. I did pull one quote that kind of addresses that from the supplements, and it was just when, you know, one of those moments when Murakami is kind of, you know, speaking to himself, and he said, quote, "It will truly be a children's film to the disappointment of adult audiences." Hmm. And he actually was surprised, but sort of accepted that. So I think he realized that, he anticipated at least my reaction. I don't know about you guys. Sorry, yeah. Matt, go ahead.
No, I think that's very true. I think the biggest problem that that I had with the film, and I did enjoy the film, but I think the biggest flaw in going through the supplemental, especially the documentary about the process of writing and creating the film, mm-hmm. It was that was the biggest idea that went wrong, is the confusion of audience, mm-hmm. in that it really very much is a film aimed for children that is done that way. And if it were aimed specifically at that, I think it probably would have been a little more successful, because some of the thematic choices that maybe are crowding parts of the narrative would sure. have been culled. So I think that was the biggest thing, is it for adults? Is it for children? And it kind of ends up being a little bit for both. And in that way, it kind of makes it mediocre at both. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a biting political satire, even though there's things in there that really try to aim at that. And
sure.
Does the happier parts to it that would satisfy more of a kid's film style, but it also sort of has some failings with that, because it wants the heavier handed stuff. But there is, there is a lot of, successful parts incorporating the pieces. And I think you mentioned the KO2 model that I actually had to go double check, 'cause I knew it was from one of his previous pieces, but it looked to me almost like a dead ringer for several different video game fighting style genres, complete with the again, I don't watch a whole lot of anime or manga, but there is always those ones where you have the women with the very revealing clothing that are fighting and doing lots of parts where there's a very short skirt, and maybe the more perverted people watching are thinking, oh, I saw something, or there is a lot of that in that the scene where that character is focused on, that I had a giggle about, because that is definitely pretty on the nose for at least for certain video game and anime tropes.
And I should add that for people that haven't seen the film, and I think we're going to get a lot of people listening that haven't, the KO2 is a female character that came along. And you know, what's funny is I talked about manga. I've been in the East a little bit, and overseas in Asia, and so I have seen some manga, and some of it does get very racy. So actually,
ooh, yeah.
This one, I was actually surprised to hear you, Mark, say it was a little, I guess, voluptuous, because it seemed pretty tame to me, I guess, just compared to what I've seen elsewhere.
It just seemed out of place with the rest of the characters that were there.
Yes,
you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, for sure.
I felt about it. It's interesting, you know, if there is a really to what Matt was saying about the audience, and I think part of what really speaks to that is the production, because they really decided within just there was a very short time frame of mm-hmm. just months, weeks and months to write this and then film it during the summer when the kids were off of school. So I think you really have, you really get that kind of view into it. It actually changed my perception a bit of the movie, maybe to a positive, Aaron, or at least I wouldn't say a positive, but just understanding what they had to work with and what they were going mm-hmm. for, and you know, their time frame. And
I appreciated, some things I didn't, but
yeah,
and we'll get into that when we get to the supplements. But
and I think that kind of, it actually, sorry to bring up one last point for it, but the you mentioned talking about sort of a very pop film, I did feel like it was definitely that, but I also felt like they were really trying to do almost like a punk rock version of a pop film, where they're doing, you know, making decisions about, yeah, we're going to do it right now and really quick and make decisions on the fly.
Right.
I know they had a conversation in the supplements about with Murakami and the other director that he worked as producer, Nishimura, who
right.
had done a lot of horror films previously. And
right.
Nishimura really put him in the way of, like, don't do a commercial film with a studio. Do it on your own. Make, you know, mm-hmm. then you'll get the idea of just making decisions on the fly and involve yourself in all of it. So I think there's an element of just flying by the seat of your pants, in the same way that
for sure
maybe somebody like you know, a lot of early filming, like maybe a Nicholas Ray, or a more modern example, maybe somebody like Takahashi Miike doing just wacky things with very violent films.
Maybe
you know,
Sam Fuller, you mentioned him earlier,
So I think there is, there's definitely the pop element, but there's a little bit of rebellion in there too.
Not enough.
I agree. It probably could have done with more.
Yeah, I would have been interested to see what a studio would have done with this if they would have made it, you know, maybe a little bit more coherent. It's tough to say. I mean, I appreciate what we have. I'd be interested to see what other minds would have brought to it. But and you know, Nishimura's a horror mind, I think, certainly helped. But I think he could have made the film even a little darker.
Well, when I think of you know, the anime that has crossed over successfully, like Miyazaki. Like, say, My Neighbor Totoro, which has unique creatures, or Spirited Away has very unique creatures, and those are very successful. You know, I'd say Totoro is far more accessible. I do kind of wonder, you know, if of course Ghibli is animated, but if there was something to keep them, their imaginations in check. And but really what came out was an imaginative formulaic film. So, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they'll pick up Jellyfish Eyes too.
Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about that too.
I really wonder. I mean, so I did want to mention I saw the same influences that you did, Aaron, in Studio Ghibli. There's some shots that I think some long shots where it's like the camera is in the grass and you see the characters walking from left to right. And I'm like, this is right from a Miyazaki movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's a quieter moment. You know, they're walking across the screen. And so there are those pieces. But this was really, originally he had conceived it as an animated film. And I just wonder, I mean, we've been talking about who the movie's for, the genre. I mean, do you think it would have worked better as an animated film? I tend to think maybe it would have.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Not I think it might have been more openly accepted for having some challenging parts to it.
Sure.
And they could get over the limitations with the actors, and of course, an animated film is going to take a lot more time. So, yeah, could have been.
Yeah, I had some problems with the Musashi character. He's the lead, and I thought he was maybe the weakest actor of all the kids. So that was a tough thing to get over.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't really get into any of the actors, and I know it's always tough with Japanese actors, but you know, I also watched Still Walking recently, and you have child and old actors that are all phenomenal. So, yeah, they're there.
I think a lot of the acting reminded me, and actually a lot of things in the film reminded me of House.
Yeah,
the same thing. Schlocky, you know, over the top emotions, overly happy, overly sad, overly dramatic. But in a way, there's parts of that I really enjoyed, and parts where you kind of roll your eyes at. But there's definitely a style to what they're going for, which also probably is a bit of Nishimura's influence with being a horror director and a low budget at that. So,
and we should say that his work was not exactly high quality work, too. And in fact, there's one supplement where Murakami is watching it and pretty much saying, this is excrement. But it also seemed, and I were kind of talking about the supplements already, but it seemed that he was more of a factor in the production than Murakami. And in fact, there's that one scene, a supplement scene where Murakami's sitting down and he said he has nothing to do. And they said, do you want to even say action, and he goes, no, he's better at that. Yeah. He's more of a leader. So you kind of wonder if he's to blame for it not realizing.
Yeah, I blame both of them, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Share blame equally.
Yeah. Or can we blame Canada? Or no, I guess we have to blame Japan.
We're not even a real country anyway.
That's true. Yeah. Yes, you are. So I think we know how Matt and I feel about this movie. What do you think, Mark? Are you with us?
I'm definitely with you. I'm probably a little more positive, and it sounds like Matt is too, I'm there a bit. It's funny, I read the DVD talk review, and I'd have to agree that I actually appreciated the supplements more, a bit more than the movie. I mean, it's fine. It just doesn't really coalesce, like we've said. The themes, I mean, the animation is fun. And we'll talk about the Blu-ray more, but I guess overall it's fine. I'll certainly revisit it. I was a little disappointed when I had it on that I watched it myself, and then I had it on later because I thought my son, who is into Pokemon, might get into it, and we talked about the audience, but he didn't really tune in. I thought, you know, seeing some of the characters, he would get into it, but really part of the block for them, and as I've tried this before, is they're not into foreign language movies.
I wondered about that. Yeah.
If it had been a dub, maybe, but even so, I thought, you know, I've put on Beauty and the Beast before, and they've gotten sucked in to that, and but not so much with this one. So, you know,
what about
intended audience didn't quite work.
Can they do Ghibli without a dub? Or, I mean, Ghibli has really good dubs, though. So,
yeah, we've always watched them with dubs too, and it's, you know, they're to the point. A few more years, they'd be fine with it. But they're, you know, age 10 and 12. The dubs definitely work for them.
What's funny is a lot of the positive comments I've heard, and there are some people that really like this film, many of them were, I watched this movie with my children, and it was a great family experience, kind of in that vein. So, in fact, I think when we get to some of the comments, you want to just go ahead and get into listener comments now?
Yeah, let's do it. So the first one I'll mention is a video that we'll embed. This was one from Brian Fernandez. He had made actually a YouTube video when he had received the Blu-ray for Christmas. And he said just he enjoyed it for what it was. It was like watching a live-action Pokemon movie. so we'll embed his review. Certainly would agree with what he was saying there. That's probably the number one thing I've heard people say is it's, you know, like a live-action Pokemon movie. So, and I think we did. You want to reference David's?
Yeah, and comments? I think I'll bring David back some because he gave me a good bit here. But he said it's visually striking and often beautiful, technically impressive, and I think we all agree on that part. It's especially given the production value or the production, I guess the budget, and we'll get into that as well. He said that he kind of forgave the cast because he was more in the action adventure film mold, and it was aimed at an audience with children, which he pointed out. He did say that Murakami incorporates themes that intrigues him as an adult. He said he plays with conventional tropes such as the bullied orphan that gets help with by magical creatures to tap into his own powers in a wacky sci-fi context. Hello, Harry Potter. but he liked that part, and he probably likes Harry Potter, and I do too, but I don't like this like Harry Potter. But he said it was knowing the inside jokes. Now his children, his grown children, are very much into Pokemon and this sort of culture, and so he said it was a nice mix of knowing inside jokes and the surprises. He said that his kids both work professionally in the industry, so he has maybe a little bit of bias towards the ingredients in this film. But he also appreciated Criterion to stretch out and incorporate something that's really not in their wheelhouse. And I think that's a question we can ask as well.
Yeah, I completely agree there. It's nice that, I mean, it's the type of movie that it came out in 2013. We wouldn't see it otherwise. So it's, you know, like I said, a pop film, something outside of what they normally release. So, you know, I support it.
And when it was announced, it kind of came out of nowhere, too. And a lot of people didn't know what it was. And when they found out, they didn't want to know what it was.
it didn't do, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are generally for something that Janice tours, but it really made, I was looking at the numbers because, you know, the U.S. numbers were, it's about 8,000 for domestic gross. I don't know how that compares, but gives you a sense of, you know, how well it did as it toured from Janice Films.
Yeah. I don't think, probably the DVD sales are probably the biggest money maker here in the States. Probably didn't do too well theatrically. So I don't know if it came out in other countries.
Yeah. Probably. So I'll just share a couple of, these are on the funnier side, some Letterboxd comments that folks had. So Brian Tellerico said, my kid watches Pokemon nearly every day. It's really annoying. It's not this annoying. It's funny. And we had, there's one from Joe Prestiani, I believe it is. Tell them this is the reason I killed myself. That was a half star review.
I saw that, yeah.
And one from Cthulhu is, did I just get punked by Criterion? So, you know, it's, there's some funny comments out there. And I would just share, I kind of felt like this movie was almost like, I didn't really believe it was going to be released. I know we talked about this some, Aaron, leading up to it. Like maybe it was a joke, the Jellyfish Eyes trailer, two trailer being on there. You know, it just didn't feel real until I put it in my player and watched it. But I'm with David there. I think it's nice that they branched out, and I actually am glad that they released it.
I think Criterion did that to us with those two fake announcements they did several years ago of Kindergarten Cop and Chud.
Oh, right.
That's right.
Maybe this, in fact, one person did, I wish I'd saved this. They generally thought that this was a punishment from Criterion for us complaining about something. Probably whoever said that probably wouldn't want to put their name on it.
It's the dual format fiasco. That
it
was
might
the
be.
Culprit.
I actually have some comments, too. Raphael Mana said, melodramatic Pokemon. He said, I have no idea what this was, but I didn't hate it. And he gave it 3 stars. Three out of five. Admiral Beamish, who is Jason, I believe, he listens to the show. He said, It's a perfect example of trusting the people whom you claim to trust. He said, I would not have watched this film. It was not Criterion. And he didn't like the trailer, but he did like the film. He gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars. He said it looked like a live action Pokemon stylized children's movie. And I think that's the conclusion we've reached. He said it filled him with wonder. Then Rod Penaflor said, amazing visuals, would love more like this from Criterion. And hold on, I have a funny one. Somebody else said, good Lord, someone went and let Japan make a Pillsbury Doughboy movie. That was Justin La Liberty. So, yeah.
Funny stuff.
There's some hate.
Yeah.
That's, you know what, good on Criterion for taking the plunge on something that's different.
It's a risk, yeah. And I should, let me get back to David here, too. In regards to whether it belongs in the collection, he said it actually is a good representational inclusion of contemporary J-pop culture into the collection. He says, the style and sensibility of Jellyfish Eyes has a massive reach and influence that will continue to grow, even as it presumably evolves in new ways. He calls it an important contemporary film, which he feels keeps with sticks with Criterion's mission. And then he said, Murakami's stature as a serious artist of substantial reputation and broad impact. He said he can't think of a better label to publish the film for home viewers. But he also notes that Criterion did put a lower MSRP on this. And
they
said by keeping the retail price lower, he thinks that Criterion shows they understand this isn't a film that everyone in the usual audience will appreciate or enjoy. But that could easily be said about lots of movies. You know, I'm sure a lot of people might say the same about Tiny Furniture, and maybe some of the ones without features, like, The Organizer that we talked about with Caitlin.
Mm-hmm.
Even as early as something like Chasing Amy.
The Rock, Armageddon. So there
Armageddon.
You go. That ends all whether this belongs conversations.
Yeah.
So those are stacked, but this one does have some supplements. But you know, we do want to talk about those briefly. But you know, what do you guys think? What would you give it as this Jellyfish Eyes as an overall film rating? And I'll kick it to you first, Matt.
I think there's probably two ways to rate this for me. There's the film, and then there's the Criterion release. Film-wise, I think probably the film gets, a really loving 5, 6 out of 10, maybe.
Okay.
But as a release, and I think one of the things that elevates the release to be something worthy of a Criterion spine number and interesting as something to dive into is the supplements and the film and everything together to really see the process of an established artist taking steps into the film industry. I think there's a lot of I want to learn, you know, Murakami talked about learning the language of film as he goes. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of really great creative energy and ideas that you can see bursting from the seams throughout those. But it really shows the baby steps of someone learning to become a filmmaker. And I think that would, for the release, take it up to me to a 7. Even though the film is definitely divisive, I would definitely recommend it as something to watch to appreciate the process of filmmaking from the lens of an outsider.
Hmm. Okay. How about you, Aaron?
Well, okay. Old Aaron said 3 out of 10. There are strengths, and I kind of touched on this earlier. I did like the creatures and the creature models. I think I gained some respect for them as I saw the supplements. And I didn't really like the school fight scene. That one's and there was an outdoor fight scene with the friends. I liked the later one, the video game kind of scene with was it KO2? Do I have it?
Mm-hmm.
Or did I forget it already?
KO, yeah, and yeah, with the two children, Yuki and whatever the other one was.
So I did like that fight scene quite a bit, and also another thing that came up in the supplements is that this movie cost 30 million yen, and as Matt might be able to relate, the yen is not very comparable to the dollar. So I'm sorry, Matt. As somebody that just booked Canada a trip, I saw that price difference firsthand. But anyway, the yen is a much just different currency than the dollar. So I actually looked up that translates to $250,000 U.S. mm-hmm. dollars. That's very low budget. Now, I have a feeling that was just like the pre-production and the character models and maybe like the shoot. I'm sure the effects cost a lot more than that. You know, who knows? Maybe it got up to a million U.S. But it's still, I think for what they got on the screen, based on what they paid for it, I think they did make the most out of their budget.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, and the visual characters, I think, oftentimes are beautiful. And that potato kind of character looked great too. A lot of them. That said, everything else, you know, I have to be somewhat objective. So where can I go from a 3? So I went down to a 2. Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. Sorry.
Wah wah.
Yeah.
I guess I'm probably still more on the side of bad. I mean, I gave it a 5 coming out of it. I did think, as we've talked before, the themes didn't quite coalesce as I would have hoped that they would, although I did enjoy the visuals. The film did take me 3 nights to get through, although that was more on my side than the film side. I can't blame it for that.
It's fine. I'll forgive you.
I'd blame it if it was, you know, really blameworthy, but, you know, it's fine. I don't know if it's one I'll revisit anytime soon until my kids are maybe ready for it. But and you guys did mention the supplements. I think it
actually
does.
Mark, sorry, let me revise mine. I said where can I go from a 3? I'm going to go 2.5.
2.5.
Right.
Okay.
So I'm half of you guys. Two is harsh. So anyway,
peer pressure. Yeah. We keep talking. We'll get you up to a 5 here sometimes.
No, 2.5 as high as I go.
So Matt did reference the supplements. We talked about it being a lower MSRP of $30, and it does have some supplements on it. It's a new high definition digital master, although it was created completely digitally. So some interesting notes there in the booklet. It has a 5.1 DTS master audio. Interview with director Takashi Murakami, a piece about the special effects making the Friends. There's the art of the film. It's about a 40-minute behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of the film and a trailer for Jellyfish Eyes 2,
woo-hoo,
essay in the booklet, of course, too. So, what did you guys think about the supplements?
Well, my favorite was the Murakami interview, and I think just because that kind of bridged his artistic background to the film and talked about his motivation. And also he did talk about some of what he wanted to accomplish thematically. You know, we haven't gotten into, you know, really the environmental or the technology. And maybe since probably a lot of people haven't seen this film. That's probably something to discuss later. But there was an earthquake near a power plant prior to the film, and that's actually really what gave him the idea. And I think having watched it, I can see where that the message came out of that. So yeah, I really enjoyed him just hearing him talk, actually reading him talk. I got to be honest, I liked Jellyfish Eyes too. I thought the trailer looked pretty cool. It looked like there was more budget. Even though I poo-pooed this one, I'm going to watch Jellyfish Eyes too. Now, whether Criterion comes out with it is a different story.
Right. Yeah, it makes you wonder. I mean, that was kind of my question, is how it did in Japan, because if that film has a bigger budget, it seems like maybe it did do well, but... Yeah. Any of the supplements stand out to you, Matt?
I really, really enjoyed the one where they really dove into the actual making of the creature models, the friends.
Yeah, that was good.
I actually, when I first found out about the film, didn't even think that would have been what they did. I kind of imagined them just filming it and CGIing everything in from artistic drawings, being that it was an artist-based concept, but the fact that there was actually models created and then used as props as mm-hmm. they were filming, I thought that was fascinating, because that's something that you really don't see much of anymore, the actual physical creation of something artistic, especially if it's a sci-fi fantasy. So, and they did a lot of changes to this and that in the clay models, and that I thought was very, very interesting
to
cool, watch.
Yeah.
And, even if I may not revisit the film again in the recent future, that would be something that I would throw it in just to see again, because I thought that was a really fascinating process.
Yeah, they made a real size model rather than a small model, and they talked about how they've been staying up all night. Yeah, I was impressed by that too. Yeah, but having seen it on the screen, I think they did use the models kind of as stand-ins, but they animated all of them, I think.
Around it, yeah.
The fights that you can't do that with with character, with clay models.
Right. Like, Luxor was for the most part real, it looked like,
right.
But other than that, yeah.
And
it was probably the only one.
The potato thing was real too, but was, they probably used the model more with him. I don't know what they call that potato thing. It might not even be a potato. That's what I call it.
Potato's good.
They did also use a lot of interesting parts, so with the one shot where it was from the Kuragibo's point of view, where he's eating
the
chikamas.
There.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And that's something that gets lost in a lot of sort of modern CGI technology. And, I kind of subscribe to the theory of, if you can use a prop and make
practical
it realistic,
yep.
you should
Do
be
it.
Doing it. So.
And if it's not Reese's Pieces, might as well make it this cheese fish stick.
Nice. Another E.T. reference.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That's good.
And
I did like the interview the best. Director guys, I always say, just, where he was coming from. They talked about some of the background of the 1967, 68, the Ultra series. Guy who created the special effects in Godzilla, and I think it gives you a sense of the culture here a bit, and where this film came from. So that was my favorite. I would say I actually found the art of the film a little bit boring at 40 minutes, but it's pretty solid, especially for, like we said, a lower MSRP, pretty nice set of supplements.
I'm with you. I thought it was impressive, but I did find myself pausing and coming back to that one as well.
Yeah. So overall, we like to give it a Criterion rating. So Matt, what would you give it as a package?
I think probably as a package, the package to me, Aaron's differing on this, I know, but the package elevated at least the experience of watching the film. So, I would think probably in the range of a 6.5 or a 7.
All right. Aaron?
Well, I might surprise you guys here. I will take the lower price in the equation, and did enjoy, and anything that focuses on bringing art to film I think is interesting. So I actually really did like the supplements, and I do like that it's different. And I kind of wonder, and who knows what went, how the acquisition process happened, because we never saw this film. Maybe somebody there that is into Pokemon saw it and championed it for Criterion, but who knows why they brought it. But I'm glad that they actually did take a risk with a foreign film. And you know, they've done that before, and it's paid off. And so anyway, I'm going to give it a 5.5 for Criterion rating. And really, I was 5, but the low price pushed it up another half a point. So I would say that, you know, if you're a completist, you have to buy it.
Yep.
If you have kids that are into Pokemon, I would definitely buy it. But if you're a guy like me, I probably wouldn't.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what kind of penetration there is for folks that aren't completists for this film. I mean, I'm really more, I guess, in between you. I gave the film a 5. For a Criterion rating, I'll give it a 6 because I think the supplements do increase the score. Though I, you know, with the documentary, I found it a bit slow. I would say for the Blu-ray, I thought it really is kind of perfect image quality. I mean, it was shot digitally, although I think it distracted me a bit because it looks a bit like TV at times. So you know, it didn't quite, I don't know, feel. I didn't quite see the if there was some realism in this film with the mix of the, you know, the live action wasn't quite there for me, but overall it's a 6. And you know, we have a Criterion canon, and I've got a feeling I know where this is going here.
Do we have a Criterion commode?
We do now.
No, I wouldn't even, I'm joking, I wouldn't even put it there. No. I still think I think the more of a question is whether Criterion should put this out. And you know, I wouldn't make it, I would, you know, I wouldn't make it a habit of them putting out films that are 18% on the tomato meter. Of course, that tomato, the reviews might have come after the release, so I didn't look at the dates. So, but of course, it's not a canon. It's not a commode either.
No. So that was Jellyfish Eyes from Takashi Murakami. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And, of course, we want to thank you, Matt Sheardown. You were a great guest. We had a lot of fun talking to you.
Thanks for coming on. No, thank you. It's like I said, it's a little serendipitous to come into contact, but really enjoyed it. I like I said, most of my film buff friends don't live in the same city as me, so any chance I get to talk about it, I'm more than happy to oblige.
Yeah, come back and do some more videos, and we'll help you promote them some. And,
yes.
And maybe next time you can come back for a film you like a little more.
So, Matt, where can folks find you online?
I am on a very infrequently updated Twitter account, at Matt Sheardown. My YouTube channel name is Matty S. Down, capital S. But if you go to YouTube and just search Criterion Close-Up, you'll find my lonely episode there with the wacky sea and black background on the front. And if there are any people that are video gamers and like the Twitch streaming, like I mentioned with the channel I share with my brother is Terrible Gaming Brothers on twitch.tv.
Cool. Excellent. And folks can find the show Criterion Close-Up online, CriterionCloseUp.com/podcast, Criterion Close-Up on Facebook, Criterion CU is the Twitter handle. And where can folks find you online, Aaron?
AWest505. Same every
Mark
week.
Herney. at Mark Herney. It's H-U-R-N-E. Letterboxd. Hoping to put my top 10 list there soon, so we'll kind of pimp that later. And we've got one more iTunes review recently, but could use some more. Just take a minute. It helps increase the listenership for us. So if you get a second, even just a quick review or just a star rating, all you have to do is click the star, and please, a 5-star review would be great.
Yeah, 1 star is no thanks. Although a lot of Jellyfish Eyes fans are. Maybe we should walk this one back.
5-star review, 2-star film.
Right. So next week we'll be talking about Fat Girl, a little bit, one of the early Blu-ray releases from Criterion. So thanks, everyone, for joining. This is Criterion Close-Up.